Welcome to the Science and Cocktails podcast.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting.
And now the machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within a group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
Am I true? Am I awake?
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes behind?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. Go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
This is the sound of a gigantic mass of ice, floating on the top of a small layer of water, over a great distance of land, straight into the ocean, where it melts and adds to the rising of the sea levels, all over the world. This episode is about melting of the Greenland ice sheet, which is one of the greatest contributors to the rising of the global sea levels. And we'll be in company with this guy.
I am Jason Box. I am a physical climatologist who studies Arctic ice and focuses on Greenland ice. We say ice-climate interactions, that's atmosphere-ice interactions. So I'm at the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland for already 7 short years.
Jason Box was first order on a large-scale study published in April 2019, showing that the global warming is pushing the Arctic towards an unprecedented state. He will tell us about some of the amplifying processes that makes the Greenland ice sheet melt much faster than predicted. And despite him being a very fun and cheering man, he has some very depressing things to say about how fast the ice is melting.
Warm weather, lots of melt on this day. The whole ice sheet was moving that much faster towards the coast.
Jason Box has participated in 30 scientific expeditions to Greenland, and he has been a lead author on several significant reports on climate change. During his 26 years of research in Arctic, he has seen with his own eyes how the ice is melting and how the landscapes are changing dramatically, resulting from a climatic system out of balance.
I remember one time just not recognizing this really huge glacier, and it had lost its ice shelf, and the science community didn't understand at that point in time, in the year 2002, this was, that this disintegration had started in 3 years earlier. It was driven by warm ocean currents that were undercutting this glacier. And at the same time, the surface melt was increasing. And so this glacier is being attacked from below and above by warming climate. And elsewhere in the south, the ice is melting even faster. And there you see really dramatic changes on glaciers. Some of them don't even have any names. And the marine charts, when you're in a boat approaching the front of the glacier, the map ends and you keep going up the fjord. And the map only has, you know, ice up to some point, and then there's nothing on this marine chart, navigational chart. But then you keep going another like 5 kilometers. And that's a very impactful way to recognize these changes that are, they're really accelerating, they're intensifying. And so I say it's no longer subtle, the changes, they're really obvious now.
Okay, And when did you start seeing the changes? You said you saw this in 2002. Was that the first time that it was really obvious that something is already changing?
Yeah, 2002 was an important year because that was the first time where the measurements that the science community made demonstrated a very sensitive response of the ice to how much melt there was from day to day.
The acceleration of the melting of the ice is driven by the changes in the energy budget, which is the sum of variables like air temperature, wind speed, humidity, weather, intensity of sunlight, and the thermal infrared radiation coming down from the sky.
And so in the summertime, there is a surplus of energy, and that drives melting. In winter, there's a deficit of energy, and that's why everything is starting to freeze up. So by studying the different components of the budget, you learn a lot about the processes that control melt. For example, a dark surface will absorb more sunlight during the almost 24 hours summer day.
And then there's the mass budget, which is about the mass of ice.
Snowfall adds to the budget, and melt and icebergs breaking off takes away. And there should be a balance. And in stable periods of Earth's climate, you have a stable mass budget. And the fact that the temperatures are rising globally is driving ice out into a mass budget deficit. And that's why, you know, ice is melting. And we understand the details of that. So
all these parameters are monitored at different monitor stations over the Greenland ice sheet. But also the developing satellite technology has contributed to an increased awareness of how fast the ice is melting in Greenland.
And now we have more detailed pictures of how the Earth's environment is changing with higher quality sensors, higher resolution, higher time coverage. So now you can observe glaciers daily, globally. And so that flood of information has profoundly improved our ability to recognize the very sensitive response of ice to abrupt climate change.
The global sea level rose 11 to 16 centimeters in the 20th century. And scientists predict that even with immediate cuts to the carbon emission, it might rise another 50 centimeters in this century. And if the carbon emission continues to increase, it might even rise up to 2 meters. The rising sea level is not only driven by the melting of the inland ice, but also by expansion of the ocean due to the rising temperature.
Now we have 50% more CO2 in the atmosphere. That most of that energy excess is going into the oceans. That is making the oceans expand. That's half of global sea level rise is thermal expansion, or about more than one third of sea level rise. Actually, then ice is taking over. Thermal expansion used to be about half, and now ice has become the dominant sea level rise. And now Greenland is the largest single regional source on Earth for sea level rise. And Antarctica will probably take over in the next century. But right now, Greenland is one of the key places to study sea level rise.
Both the global, the scientific, and the political concern about the climate changes has increased dramatically in the recent years, as it has become obvious to the majority that climate change is happening. Not in the future, but right now. But awareness, both public, scientific, and political, is not new. In the mid-1970s, climate change shifted from being a scientific issue to be an issue of political concern. The international political discussion of climate change began in June 1973 at the UN Conference on the Human Environment in Stockholm. The conference identified a need for states to work cooperatively to solve environmental issues on the global scale. Despite nearly 50 years of concern for the future of the global climate, very little has been done. And now we are way too late to stop the environmental responses to the rising temperatures. And it is like a snowball rolling down the hill. Because the rise of the temperatures are causing several amplifying processes.
And this is why the Arctic climate warming happens three times faster than the global average. And so, for example, we now see more rainfall instead of snowfall. And you can imagine that a wet surface or a surface that's where the rain is just draining off of the land and the ice, that surface is darker. So the story begins maybe with rain instead of snow, and then the story continues with a darker surface absorbing more sunlight. That amplifies the melt process. And the bare ice area of glaciers is much darker than the snow-covered area. So the bare ice area that's on the lower parts of glaciers, and that's normal, but that's expanding in, over a larger area and expanding over the flatter upper areas of the ice. And so when melt rises to a flatter part of the ice, a given increase in elevation is amplified by the shape of the ice, because you're raising the bare ice area into a flatter part of the ice. So we call that hypsometric amplification. It's just based on the fact that the shape of the glaciers is not triangular. It's like a parabolic shape. So that would be a third amplifier based on the shape of the ice. So we have observed like a doubling in the surface melt happening at the surface of glaciers across the Arctic. And so that is increasing the water that drains into the many cracks across the surface of glaciers. And so that increased water supply is heating the ice internally, and warmer ice is softer than cold ice, and that means the ice can deform more easily under gravity because it's warming internally. Some have called this thermal collapse. Then the story continues. The same water reaches the bed, the bottom side where the ice is in contact with the land, and the water lubricates the flow. The movement is accelerated by the presence of meltwater, because melt is water is a hydraulic fluid. It is incompressible. So kilometers of ice can glide on a thin film of water. And when water is really being generated fast at the surface, then you can even pressurize the bed of glaciers and lift them up, and then they're flowing even faster. So that's fascinating, right? The water then continues out the front of the glacier and forces a convective heat exchange between a warming ocean and the ice. And this has an undercutting effect at numerous marine terminating glaciers, where the grounding line, that's where the ice begins to float or begins its contact really with the ocean. And you get erosion of the ice right at the grounding line, which is a very sensitive place. When you melt ice at the grounding line, it reduces the friction, the back stress. It's like the land is pushing back, or as the ice is pushing forward, but you remove that back stress and you get some acceleration of the glaciers. So I've just mentioned, I don't know, five or six amplifying processes that produce a sensitive glacier response. And you know, there are others. If we want to talk about the atmosphere, And just quickly, more heat is being transported into the Arctic atmosphere through the atmospheric circulation, and so that then you've got a warmer air mass. It is radiating more thermal radiation downward to the surface. That's enhancing melt. Well, really across the Arctic Ocean, a really important amplifier is the Arctic sea ice, which when it melts away, it exposes a much darker ocean surface that's something like a factor of 5 increase in absorbed sunlight between snow-covered sea ice and open water. So that's a huge amplifier. And so as Arctic sea ice is melting away, the ocean surface is several degrees warmer than the atmosphere. And especially in the winter, the open water is like 20 Celsius warmer than the atmosphere. And so you get a huge amount of energy coming out of the ocean into the atmosphere during the freeze-up period of Arctic sea ice. And so that's heating the atmosphere. So kind of like the glaciers are getting attacked from below and above, it's the same with Arctic sea ice, because actually ocean warming is the big climate story, really. The oceans are absorbing 90% of the energy imbalance that our planet has because of elevated CO2.
The rising temperatures causes increasing rainfall and decreasing snowfall, which makes the surface of the ice darker, and therefore it absorbs more sun. The melt water goes into the ice sheet and heats it up internally, and creates a water surface below the ice sheet, which makes it possible for the ice to slide on the water surface over a great distance of land, and eventually fall into the ocean, where it will melt, because the water temperature is higher than the temperature in the air, and it will make the mass of the water in the ocean increase, and it will cover big areas of land, making people homeless and without food supply. But it won't be the houses of the rich populations that will disappear, and it won't happen in the rich countries.
And it's also a bourgeois or a rich person's problem to even, you know, talk and think about this stuff, because a lot of poor people are not getting the advanced education about these types of issues, nor do they have the economic extra capacity to put money aside and make these kind of investments. So it's really a wealthy person's problem to talk about it. And it's also the wealthy people that have created this problem. Mm-hmm. The poor, they are impacted more. The poor don't have the capacity to invest in expensive infrastructure to slow down sea level rise, or the poor people, they can't afford to move. And so, climate emergency is very unfair to nature, to poor people. It's just a big mess.
Though the rich part of the world carries the largest responsibility of the global warming and has the capacity to do something about it, it won't. Because in those countries, there will also be the resources to maintain a way of living and to build defenses against the rising ocean. It will be the poor people in the poor countries who will suffer. The people who are already hungry because of the increasing frequency of droughts, making it difficult to produce enough food. And all these hungry, homeless people will try to get a better life in the rich countries, but only few of them will succeed. And this is just one of many dark future scenarios. So is it still possible to stop the climate changes, or are we just way too late because of all these amplifying processes, making the snowball roll faster and faster downhill?
It's really hard to have hope. However, we still have a strong impact on future climate by whatever changes we make to the rate that we're adding carbon to the atmosphere. That you're actually dialing the knob on a amplifying process. So it'll always be true that the actions that we make now have amplified impacts later. So we whatever actions we take to limit carbon emissions will have a compounding slowdown effect on future warming. But we're not going to stop the climate continuing warming until we reverse the enormous transfer of carbon to the atmosphere, which today is about 40 billion tons net increase in atmospheric CO2. It is like science fiction to contemplate the technologies that would be required to take that carbon out of the atmosphere. It would involve handling several cubic kilometers of air per second, and the energy required to scrub carbon out of the air is enormous. So you can hypothetically discuss the types of technologies or policies that would achieve the climate cooling or the stabilization. However, those are distant considering today's policies. And even under aggressive carbon emission reduction policies, for example, the Paris Climate Agreement, that's about limiting warming to under 2 Celsius globally. That would be about 6 or 8 Celsius in the Arctic. That's the Paris Climate Agreement. Making that a success requires a globally coordinated effort that so far has not materialized. Like, there's a growing gap between the promises or the pledges that were made in Paris 5 years ago and the reality that we have now. So it's easy to talk about this stuff. Talk is cheap, but the action are, you know, expensive. And that's why there's a lot of kind of economic opposition to the transformations of the global economic system that would be required to achieve the Paris Climate Agreement. That underlies the resistance you get from kind of like status quo policy politicians like Donald Trump or Australian government, Brazil government, even China. So the largest economies globally so far are not playing this game because they perceive that their capacity to get wealthy is being threatened. And to some degree that's true, but on the other hand, making the rapid transition to a more sustainable economy would also have winners. It would just be like different winners, you know? So like the people that are winning under the current system don't want to give that up because they are deeply cynical, greedy kind of people.
We are on an avalanche heading straight for the ocean, and we do nothing to make it slow down. We're just rolling along, pretending that it's not a big deal. We know that bad things are coming, but we will not change our way of living to avoid drowning in the future. And we will drown. Because very soon, the avalanche we are sitting on will reach the ocean. The ice will melt very fast because the ocean is already warm. The mass of water in the ocean will increase, and it will cover big areas of land. So we all know, or at least most of us know, that we need to do something dramatically to prevent future disasters. But still, we don't do much. I asked Jason Bucks why he thinks it is like that.
Because the scientists have been concerned about climate change for decades, there's a profound understanding of a lot of the fundamentals. we know what's needed to stabilize climate. We know that the sources have almost everything to do with our economic systems. And you can see how on the one hand complicated this is, but in principle it's really quite simple.
So how is it simple?
Yeah, the simplicity is we know what we need to do. We need to stop putting carbon in the atmosphere. On the complicated side, humans need to reach a reciprocal relationship with nature. Humans have been taking from nature and degrading nature when, by definition, the sustainable relationship between humans and nature would have an equal give and take. So we need to sustain nature. Why? Because nature is our life support system, but we are destroying nature, and there is a more harmonious way to approach this. However, it doesn't seem that our species has the capacity to make the intelligent choices that would be genuinely sustainable, even though these types of choices have been defined already for decades. Carl Sagan, you know, said in the 1970s, we need a massive scale reforestation project for Earth. People would benefit from that. Today, 30, 40 years later, global forests are in decline, as is, you know, plant and animal populations globally. So we have not been successful so far. Can we reverse that is the big question, but it looks very doubtful. And so it's useful to talk in probabilities. What is the probability of this species to sustain itself and to sustain nature? It looks really low probability, and it's likely that people's survival needs to be more directly threatened before they make the tough decisions. And that is another well-understood aspect of human behavior. So, and it's surprising that the fires in Australia and Amazonia and droughts didn't make people think, because I think it's because the fires, they stop at some point, you know, and then people are like, oh, that was terrible, let's go back. But then there's corona, right? So how useful is corona in this? We now know it's been enough months that carbon emissions haven't really decreased a lot under the corona crisis.
It hasn't?
No. It's a little mysterious, you know. Well, okay, so there's less airplanes flying, but those are only about 15% of emissions. So there's, then I think people are, you know, consuming more, but we're getting some practice of being under stress as a society, and that's a similar kind of stress that climate, if abrupt climate change intensifies further, like in surprising ways, and it can do that, then of course people will have more attention on their survival being directly threatened instead of indirectly threatened. Like migration is an indirect threat, but you know, the sea waves, you know, flooding your basement, that is a direct threat, or flooding your cities. We'll see more of that in the tropics than in the north or the far south.
But I think also, for example, with corona, then when you make a lockdown, then you get a direct response that the numbers go down. But if you are start doing some radical things because your life is threatened because of the climate, then you won't see this direct response right after, because it would take so long for the climate to stabilize.
Right. You do not see the return on investment for decades. The problem is, like, our political and economic systems are geared for a much shorter turnover, like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 years, not 40 years. So we are fundamentally not geared. Our system doesn't have the right gears You know, for spinning it at the right speed to deal with this. So the probability of success is very low.
Yeah. But I think, like, we worry so much about the future of our children.
Right.
Like, the amount of effort and investment we put in our children, that's enormous. So this is the most important way to invest in our children's future. But still, it's like, it's maybe it's too...
Yeah, it's like too long term.
Yeah, too long term.
Well, I think of all the parents out there, those that are making investments now for their children's livelihoods in 30 years, that's actually a small fraction of parents. We lack a good long term planning, both in our political systems and even as individuals. And there's some political ideological barriers to global coordinated efforts because. There are some people that are really attached to their local sovereignty, and that doesn't that have an origin in tribalism? You know, because it's like us and them. So humans need to get over tribalism. However, I think tribalism might actually be physically encoded into our brains. It's kind of, you can objectify it and be like, yeah, you know, that is right that we're on one world and we should treat each other brothers and sisters, and you know, the animals are our brothers and sisters, but we don't behave that way.
I had some difficulties trying to find the right way to end this story. We all like a happy ending, but it's really hard to find one for this one. But it could be an open ending, because to slow down the accelerating climate change, we need to change our way of thinking fundamentally. If we'll be able to do that, if the effects of the climate changes will make us do that, only time will tell. Thank you for listening to the Science and Cocktails podcast, which is funded by the Novo Nordisk Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort, for Science and Cocktails. The music is originally composed by Hjalte Bisted Møller and me, also known as Trumleorkestret.